Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to On the Time Lash. This is our Doctor's Daughter Galaxy 4 episode. I am Ben, and with me... Hello, Mark! So, Mark, how have you been, mate? Oh, really? And what else did you do? Oh, nice, nice. Sorry, okay.
You've completely covered the tabletop with water.
I don't even understand how that happened. I may, is there some napkins behind the bar?
Just on the table beside the door.
So there he is, his brilliant impression of a half.
Hiya. How we doing?
So this is...
I hope the microphone picked that up, because otherwise this wet table was for nothing.
Yeah, it will do. That was loud. Yeah, near enough to the microphone, good. That's alright.
I think if I ever need to do a half impression in the future, big finish if you're listening, yeah. I'll maybe bring the straw a bit higher up in the glass, because I think that's what the problem was. Too much air from the bottom forced the water up through the glass. And
God, he's a regular Nick Briggs, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. We're continuing our season 4 watch through, and we are at the Doctor's Daughter, and we've paired it up with Galaxy 4.
Indeed,
for reasons we'll get into
as we discuss them. Yeah. What are you drinking, Ben, for this episode?
What am I drinking? So I have a pint of the delicious pale ale, Peter as well, in celebration of our guests, our Georgia Moffat, who has sprung from Peter as well. Peter Davison, that is. That is probably borderline misogynistic, isn't it, really? That
I don't know. I mean, I've never heard a man's... ball sack referred to as a well before, but
that's how we're starting this episode, ladies and gentlemen.
You know, we've already recorded the podcast before this one.
Yeah, and just kicking off talking about former Doctor Who Peter Davison's ball sack. And
it's what you've come to expect from On the Time Lash, to be honest.
That's why you listen. Don't pretend otherwise. Let's have the stats. The Doctor's Daughter by Stephen Greenhorn was broadcast the 10th of May 2008, 6:45 PM till 7:30 PM broadcast, watched by 7.3 million people. That's the old statty poos. Where, though, Mr. Markington, is it? Where is the Doctor's Daughter?
Where indeed? Where indeed?
In the first five decades poll.
It's not perfect by any stretch.
That's why I'm starting at the bottom of the list to try and find it.
I think probably 100 and... Let's go with 172.
Very near. 180.
Okay.
Between Boomtown and New Earth.
It's fair enough. Well, is it? Yeah, well...
Well, that's...
Let's discuss that in more depth.
That's essentially what we're doing here just now. The Doctor's Daughter. It is so... So we're recording this. There's going to be a bit of a... For listeners, a bit of a gap, but we're recording this on the Sunday after the final episode of the Zygon 2 has gone out. And the main thing I take away... I know it's kind of unfair to compare it with the future of the show as opposed to the past of the show. But what you find... is I've been really happy with Series 9 in that the stories have been longer. The Doctor's Daughter is a classic example of something which is just, it's just too much packed into one story, and you don't give a shit about it at the end, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, there's a line Donna has in which she goes, you know, you talk all the time but you never say anything. And I think that can be quite aptly applied to this story.
Yeah.
There's so much going on.
Yeah.
And only actually, there's only about two elements of it that really matter.
Yeah.
But neither of them are given the room to breathe that you want them to. And that's the, you know, the title, The Doctor's Daughter.
Yeah.
And that whole idea of, you know, the Doctor being presented with somebody who can, you know, who is also, who is another, essentially another Time Lord.
Yeah.
And that he can, you know, raise to be, raising his vision, I guess. It's slightly... deifying him slightly, but hey, if the series is going to do it, I might as well do it.
Yeah.
And then also the whole idea, which I think is a great sci-fi idea, of a war that's only lasted a week, but because they're constantly getting through murdering people, they're constantly replacing people, and you then
because they've got the life like the Mayflies,
Exactly. Then you get this kind of wonderful idea. Yeah. But none of it is dealt with in sufficient depth. And no. It kind of just rattles. I mean, it rattles along at a fair old pace, but it's kind of empty, really.
Yeah. Well, it is empty. I mean, maybe it should have been a two-parter. But to be honest, there's not really enough even to sustain one part. You kind of get the impression that the only reason that Martha got trapped in the TARDIS at the end of The Poison Sky is because they needed something else to be going on.
Well, I think I get that as well. My feeling of it is that the only reason she is along for the ride in this story is that you need to have the Doctor and his companion, because the companion can then sort of comment on, well, you know, this is your daughter.
Donna is a mediator.
Yeah. Between the Doctor and Jenny. So then you need somebody else, because traditional Doctor Who, the Doctor can... the Doctor can... I'm very flappy hands today.
Let's just move this pint and this other glass of water and the prop water.
You know, traditionally the Doctor and his companion will be separated, so then the companion can see the other side of the story, and you then get a full idea of what's happening.
Yeah.
So then you bring along Martha so that Donna can be there to be the mediator between Jenny and the Doctor, and Martha can find out what's going on with the Hath.
Yeah.
And it's just, she's just there as a functional part. And it's a shame, because it's kind of just like, well, why bother? why bother bringing back Fema Agyeman to just be...
Well, because they could.
Yeah.
Because they could. And... what would you rather have? A complete unknown dealing with the Hath?
True.
You know.
True.
The Hath are a friendly pred. See, we made the mistake of thinking that because Galaxy 4 is essentially about the disgusting thing is actually the good thing, whilst the, you know... The
aesthetically pleasing thing is actually the villain.
Yeah, they're the villain. That's how I remembered... The Doctor's daughter.
Yeah, but it's not really, is it?
No, it's not, because the Hath are as bad as the humans.
Yeah.
But we just find essentially a Hath version of Jenny, which is someone who's open to a bit more of an ideal and a world. Yeah. But we think that the Hath are the friendly goodies, and they're not. It's just that through Martha, we are introduced to them properly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
as opposed to them being a kind of generic
monster.
Because
they're both warlike races by this point that are in search of a common goal and will wipe out the other one to attain that goal.
Yeah, exactly. But within that you have what we'll call human elements.
Or sympathetic.
Know. Sympathetic
characters,
And unfortunately we wouldn't have had that if it wasn't Martha.
No, we wouldn't.
The actors didn't have to give the same performance. But if it was just like a random, well, if it was that pizza faced soldier guy, right? If he was adopted as the companion of the week, and we saw it through his, I wouldn't give a shit. Could not care less.
I mean, it's a shame because I think
you care about the Hath because Martha sits on a shingle beach, having watched one of them die, and she is distraught.
Yeah,
like.
Yeah.
There's a real chill to that scene. Okay, you've got that kind of little look in your face. I do sometimes think maybe it's the wrong side of embarrassment.
Maybe
it's overpitched.
I think it's okay, but I think what the problem I have with it, it's a bit Five Doctors. It's a bit Sarah Jane falling down grass.
Exactly the same thing.
It's that kind of.
If she just stuck out a foot, she'd stop.
Yeah. Oh, I'm falling down a. Yeah, it's not.
Get the car and bring the tow rope.
Yeah. If only he had.
A fallen foul of a gentle incline.
It's a bit that, so that when the actual emotional response comes, you're like, yeah, it's sad he's dead, but it all seems a bit pointless because you just kind of fell off.
I mean, that there is a moment in there where I think, why did you do that to Martha? Because that's not her character now.
No, it's
that's not the character that we saw when she wasn't a clone in the Sontaran two-parter. And that's certainly not the character that she is developing into in her little Torchwood sojourn that she had around this time as well. She essentially was the companion, the screaming girl companion.
Yeah, it's odd. And the thing is, you know, one of the problems with it in The Five Doctors is that that's not Sarah Jane's character either, really.
Yeah.
So it's just a very odd thing to do.
Yeah.
So that's why I kind of have a problem with it. But okay. I do agree that, you know, through Martha we do get a sympathetic view of the Hath, yeah. and that's a necessary thing
yeah.
to have in the story.
Yeah.
It's just a shame that there's so many other things going on that
yeah.
you kind of, there's nothing really to kind of get your teeth into.
Well,
there's little glimpses of brilliance.
Yeah.
Some real, really, really good stuff in it. But most of that is David Tennant and Catherine Tate.
Yeah. Well, so Stephen Greenhorn said he was allocated this story because he gave an interview with Doctor Who magazine where he said that from his point of view, writing Doctor Who is that you can't really give your lead character anything that fundamentally changes him.
Yes.
He can have an adventure and he can come up against villainy and aliens and creatures yeah. and all that kind of stuff and troubles and danger. By the end of the episode, he's got to be back in the TARDIS with his companion and they're off for another yeah. adventure. And RTD read this interview and went, right, we're going to give you something that yeah. does fundamentally change everything. But it doesn't. No. And you never buy into the fact that the Doctor is changed by this.
No.
Because it is so fleetingly brief.
And also the way she's killed off.
Yeah.
If we'd had a two-parter, like you say, the story isn't actually really that much. You wouldn't really be able to turn that into a two-parter anyway.
Well, you could, but it would be a character show.
Yeah, it would be maybe like, you know, again, it's not fair to judge them based on the future, etc., etc., but yeah. maybe the second part, they would have just been at the source and they would have had a very long conversation about what it is and what yeah. it can be and why they've been fighting this war and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, perhaps, you're right.
Yeah.
But what we have is we have a 45-minute episode with a villain in General Cobb who... No, you don't really understand why he's doing what he's doing. And also, I would argue he's miscast. They should have gone for a much younger actor.
Yeah.
Because he's surrounded by teenagers and young adults.
Yeah.
Which, for that, you go, okay, well, I understand the whole week-long war. But
He looks like he's been around.
He looks like he's at least been there since the beginning, yeah. so knows exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
And if that is the case, fine, but maybe it would have been nice to have had a bit more...
Explore that a bit more.
And presumably that will be why he tries to kill the Doctor at Jenny's.
Yeah.
You don't get any of that.
What's his story? Was he the second in command and he wanted the position and yeah. it's become a, you know...
Has he been there since the start and watched countless people being killed yeah. and massacred?
Yeah.
And does he want this war to not have been yeah. to have been for nothing?
Or it's as much to protect his own hide essentially the thing that he's done.
Yeah. Why does he do what he does? We don't get it. And it just feels like a really cheap... It's like, well, we can't have the Doctor knocking about in the TARDIS with his daughter for the rest of the series. We'll have to kill her off.
Yeah.
It just feels a very cheap thing just to get David... I mean, it leads to a great scene. Don't get me wrong. But it doesn't earn it.
Yeah. No,
it doesn't earn it. It's out of... If you just take that scene out of the actual episode it's in.
Yeah.
Like on like a clips package or something like that. You go, that's Doctor Who. That's what the Doctor as a character stands for. What a brilliant scene. And that's because David Tennant's such a brilliant actor.
Yeah.
And the script is really good. But the script up until that point doesn't earn the right to have that scene.
Well, considering that it's a 7-day war and that the body count... Why do they never come across...
It's staggering.
Where's all the graves?
Yeah.
Because, you know, you presume...
We don't actually see anybody die apart from Jenny, do we?
So there's two guys...
Oh, the thing explodes.
Yeah, there's two guys right at the start, yeah. You don't see anyone die. And more than that, you never see graves or bodies piled up or what the fuck ever. I mean, are there tunnels just shoved full of dead bodies and that? Like, what happens? What happens there?
Do they cremate them?
Even just a small little shot, like a pile of bodies. I can't believe I'm arguing to have seen something like that.
Dear Radio Times, I felt the lack of a scene in which stacks of bodies, offensive in the extreme. Yeah.
So what is being painted as like a grueling, bloodthirsty battle?
Mm-hmm.
You never get a sense of it. So the main danger, it seems, the main intrigue of the story is Donna working out a sequence of numbers.
Yeah.
I know. Like there's a I There's a bit where she's explaining to the doctor all about the numbers, and it must go on for, I don't know, 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And you think, this is 30 seconds too long. You're telling people about fucking numbers. What is going on here?
It's weird. I mean, but the thing is that it's such a great... It's a very 1960s Doctor Who idea.
There is... You can 100% see that in the Celestial Toymaker.
This is a numerical system that we're going to explain to
the audience. Instead of the Doctor and Donna, is Dodo and Stephen going, well, if we just keep piling the rings onto this, we're going to have to go back now. Hop, hop, hop. Oh, if we fall off the game board, we're going to be electrocuted or eaten by a fat guy or something. I don't know what it was. I haven't seen... Toy making phrases. I don't know what are they doing, but yeah, there's a lot of that, isn't there?
And one of the
reasons... Well, it is also. I mean, the whole thing's very Hartnell-esque.
Mm.
First 10 seconds out of the TARDIS. Well, firstly, it picks up from the story
beforehand.
Picks up
from the previous story, yeah.
TARDIS, something's happening. No, they get outside. Immediately, they're flung into something. Cut off from the TARDIS. One of the companions is cut off from the rest of the party.
Mm-hmm.
The stakes are high. You've got they can't not be involved in this situation.
Yeah.
And then you're off on a bit of an adventure.
And the thing is, I mean, you know, it never takes a breath.
And even, do you know what it reminds me of? Do you know what we should pair this with? The Space Museum.
Okay.
It's two warring factions that you'd never give a shit about to begin with, or believe that they're actually warring. in like a weird space that seems far too small to conceal two armies.
Well, this is the thing as well.
It's like the future zone from the Crystal Maze. How are they not bumping into each other?
I know. It's funny. It's because I made a sort of slightly sarcastic comment on Twitter that
really
imagine
you because
that's what it's there for. in which I sort of posited the theory that the reason the Half talk like this.
Yeah.
Is because we've seen this Doctor Who story countless times before and can just fill in the gaps in dialogue ourselves.
Yeah. And they seem to perfectly understand what Martha's saying. So.
Yeah, it's a TARDIS translation circuit, isn't it? Talks bubbles.
Yeah. Oh, see, on that subject, the Hath are a great looking monster.
Are they, though?
Aye, they are.
I think...
What else looks like the Hath? And what is as memorable as the Hath in just a single appearance that they have?
Oh, yeah.
Because they could totally come back.
They could. I mean, I think you're right.
They have the potential for depth. Yeah. And all you need to do is write a little line of dialogue that they've got like a translation matrix around their neck now, or they've got some sort of telepathic ability.
It would be interesting to see what he did with them now, because as we discussed in our Women Who Lived chat in the On the Time Last Extra, the prosthetics now are a lot more convincing.
Yeah.
Because the problem I have with the Hath is that it's essentially just a big... And it looks really sort of...
It's a fish hat.
It's a fish hat. It's a big plastic... And it looks really plasticky and kind of uncomfortable and cumbersome thing to wear in a boiler suit.
Yeah.
And that's why they don't quite work for me.
No,
I'm afraid to say. Just because... They don't feel like real things.
No,
to me.
They've
got these big featureless faces with this like bubbling canister in front of them.
What are you talking about? You're talking about Doctor Who monsters.
I know. There's a long history.
Fuck it out. When you get to the monoids, you just go, that's a tennis ball in a guy's mouth. He's just moving it with his tongue. He's got a mop on his head.
but that's the 60s. You know, you allow for certain things. I think, you know, when you have something like the Ood, which again, you know, it's just a latex mask, but they do so much with that mask.
Yeah.
For me, the Hath, it does seem like just a bunch of stunt actors.
Yeah.
In like big plastic headdresses and boiler suits.
Okay.
But
I'm not with you on that. But okay, I understand. I see. But what I'm arguing is that we often talk about how the new series. Fucking hell, come on! It's nearly 12 years.
It's just Doctor Who, isn't it?
It's just Doctor Who.
The modern incarnation of the television series Doctor Who. The current,
but,
I don't know.
But the modern era of it has not yielded as many iconic class baddies.
No.
And I think there's some potential in the way that the Hath certainly look, and that I'd like to see more of them. Like, they don't... Like, the Weeping Angels seem like a very one you know, they've come back, but they've always got the same thing. They're the same as modus operandi. Yeah. The Half look like they could genuinely be a three-dimensional baddie society, something to explore, something that would be good in coming back. And also, they look great, I think. And, you know, they do have the kind of the technology to make it look a bit better.
Yeah,
I'd like to see them back. But then again, that's the Doctor's daughter. It's an element that you just wish, come on, could you not have made more of this?
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, if maybe there had been more done with them, I maybe wouldn't feel so much like it's a big plastic headdress.
Yeah, yeah.
But there isn't, because there's so much else going on.
Yeah. And obviously the main something else going on is the Doctor's daughter.
Well, remember, because I wanted to try and... What I did as background reading for this episode was I read some of the reviews.
Yeah.
From that period of time. And a lot of it was what we've just said, you know, too much going on. Yeah. It's that classic example of Doctor Who, 45 minutes, trying to cram in all these big ideas,
yeah.
and none of it gets the sort of thing it deserves. But what I remember more than that was that everybody was like, ooh, the Doctor's daughter, what will it mean? You know, what's it going to mean? Is it going to be Susan's mother? Is it going to be... And you're like... The pragmatist and the, you know, the person with the common sense in your head is like, well, of course it's not.
Yeah. I love the main rule in Doctor Who is that whatever you think it is,
it's not. It's not.
Oh, what will Maisie Williams be? Oh, is she going to be Susan? Is she going to be the Rani? No, it's going to be like a new character.
It's just a new character.
That's what it will be.
It's a new character.
Because we're no longer in the period where your main source of Doctor Who is BBC books or new adventures. Like, whatever you...
Where the audience is just people that like Doctor Who.
Yeah. Whatever, as a fan, you most want it to be, right, that will never fly in a commercial primetime television program.
Exactly.
What if it's a female young Doctor from the future? What the fuck? Think of what you said. Of course it's not going to be that.
And
it's going to be Susan. It's not going to be Susan.
And that's what I was trying to figure out. I was trying to find in these reviews if there was a sense of that. Because, I mean, Twitter wasn't a thing in 2008. So, you know, I don't remember the kind of, oh my God, I can't believe. Because I was like, were people really annoyed by this? Was that what coloured people's opinions of the story?
Mm.
That they felt cheated in some way, that they felt, you know. But then I was like, well, maybe they did. But now, the people who have this sense of entitlement when it comes to Doctor Who, and it should fit this ideal that they have of a story and all that kind of thing. And I think this is an interesting thing we should maybe discuss with this story, is that when they release a title, all the ideas in your head, you know, and what that can mean.
I mean, I know this is not in his era, but Stephen Moffat's always said, go for big slutty titles.
Yeah, and that's what this is. Yeah. It's, you know, it's a big, what's that going to mean? And what I love about The Doctor's Daughter, I remember at the time watching it, I was kind of just like, you cheeky bastards, is that the TARDIS lands, the Doctor, Donna and Martha get out, and they go, ooh, where are we? Ooh. They're whisked away to this gene splicing machine or whatever. The Doctor puts his hand in, and then a girl comes out, and she goes, hello, Dad. And then you go, right, that's how she's that's the Doctor's daughter.
Yeah.
I was like... Fair play. You've just gone, do you know what? Fuck it. That's how we're getting to that point now. And that pace continues all the way through it, but which is both its blessing and its curse. But I remember loving it, that there was no mystery whatsoever. It was just like, it was a machine that took the Doctor's DNA and grew a different person out of it. So technically she's
it's a human version of the hand that he's got in the bubbly tank.
Well, I suppose, it's a sort of a foreshadowing of the climax to the series, I guess, which I've never really thought of before.
I think people are probably a lot kinder to this episode because she survives in the end. And at the time it went out, there was the promise that she was going to return.
Yeah.
If not at the end of this series, she was going to feature. There would be some meaningful... Because, you know, we're about 5-6 years later, and she's never returned and is never likely to, it seems.
Well, we're... 7 years later now.
Yeah.
Yeah, 2015, yeah.
Well, so, we're two doctors later.
Yeah.
A different producer. She's never coming back.
I wouldn't be surprised if there's the way Big Finish are going at the moment, sort of carving their way through new series mythology.
Yeah.
We'll get a Jenny, The Adventures of Jenny box set or something.
A Jenny box set, yeah. That'd be, she'll meet up the Eighth Doctor in the Time War or something.
Yeah,
like that.
And River Song.
Yeah.
And Unit.
Yeah, Jago and Lightfoot.
Yeah.
I don't know what I said, Jago, Jago and Lightfoot.
Jago Meister.
Yeah. Yeah, she survived. And it was at, apparently, the request of Stephen
Moffat. Although Stephen Moffat supposedly forgets this conversation ever happened. I read an interview with him where he was like, yeah, a lot of people, like Russell said, that I was the one that came up with the idea. I don't remember this conversation ever happening.
But what he says is that his motivation for it was just, like, everyone expects you just to kill her off, so don't do that.
So don't do that. Which I think is wise. And I think it is a nice idea that the doc... It's a shame that they've not done something with it. And, you know, again, that kind of fan... we want more of this character that, you know... And Jenny's a character that is constantly, like Maisie Williams, oh, she'll be Jenny.
Yeah.
No, she fucking won't.
Yeah.
she'll be a regenerated Jenny or a regenerated River Song. No, she won't. Yeah. She won't be.
No, she won't. It's not going to happen.
But Jenny...
Jenny is very much a strike while the iron is hot sort of a character. There is the 7 years
let
later,
it go.
Two Doctors, drastic change in the tone... of this series.
Exactly.
She's not coming back.
It's a shame, because I think...
It would be great.
It's a really great idea, and I think it was never given the kind of focus and the weight and the depth that it could have given to the series. It's a bit of a throwaway episode in the middle of a series.
Yeah.
When it could have been something that completely changes the way the rest of the series runs.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a shame.
Yeah, and that it is a throwaway episode with that title. You think they're running quite the risk.
Yeah.
Here.
Because the Doctor's wife, I think that's quite a good story to kind of compare the sort of the use of a title to, what's this going to mean?
The way that it's inviting your expectation with what it actually gives
the
you.
The Doctor's wife is very much a character piece for Matt Smith's Doctor.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of what it does is very clever. And there's like an alien plot going on, but that's kind of on the back burner. And there's this stuff with Amy and Rory, again, that's on the back burner just to kind of keep everything ticking along and be Doctor Who. So it's not just him and Saran Jones just talking to each other for 45 minutes, which would be weird for everybody.
Yeah.
Whereas this, it could have done that. It could have done that. But what I think, there's so much of the alien plot, there's so much... They're trying to sort of like colour in this world that it doesn't quite get out of the... By the time the Doctor accepts her as his daughter and what that might mean, that's the end of the story. See you next week.
Yeah. Well, what should be a very... What we get are very trite, cliched Doctor moments or... Doctor imparting knowledge bits and pieces, when what we actually want are some meaningful exchanges and we don't. We have very kind of clipped little moderated by Doctor conversations, so you get a sense that Jenny is growing and is open to another way of thinking about things. Mm-hmm. But then when you get to the end of the episode and the Hath troops and the human troops so easily put their guns down. It means, well, is she actually learning from the Doctor, or is there just something within that fighting force which is fairly malleable?
Yeah.
And it's nothing that the Doctor has
done
to change or educate her. So
it's almost, it's an interesting point, because for me that scene doesn't necessarily suggest that, you know, the Doctor's had an effect.
Yeah.
It's that they both found the source, the Doctor's explained what it is.
Yeah.
And they've
understood it.
Okay. That seems fair. Maybe we should put down our weapons and work to make this planet a...
Yeah.
Because it's this thing of hope. It's this kind of, you know, we can turn this barren wasteland into this beautiful, lush planet.
Yeah.
Where we can live in peace and harmony. And to me, that's what it's kind of suggesting. It's like, well, it's one of those stories, again, where the Doctor doesn't really... He kind of figures it out.
Doesn't matter.
Smashes a globe.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then his daughter gets shot.
Yeah.
It
smashes a globe as well.
Yeah.
It's a terraforming device. Surely there's more to it than just letting a bizarre mist out of a globe.
Should we talk about the Rathacan?
Yeah, I mean, look at what the Genesis device was. I mean, look at what that. And then, well, okay, and there also as well. So, has Jenny regenerated?
Or has she been revived by the terraforming device?
Yeah, because the mist stuff coming out of her mouth isn't regeneration energy. It's the same as the Genesis effect, we'll call it. So, is she gone all Captain Spock?
Yeah, maybe.
With it.
Well, that's the thing, because I remember that was the first time I watched it. Oh, Rathacan.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how she'll survive.
Yeah, she's got to. They've got to go. They've got to have some sort of ceremony on a Vulcan hill somewhere.
Well, the whole point
where
is
her and Donna have to be mind melded together again. Because
yeah, Donna is the sort of Dr. McCoy of the the slightly sarky, slightly grizzled companion.
Yeah, yeah, green shirted son of a bitch.
What was I saying? But no, I think because they make a very big deal of the fact that she doesn't regenerate. It seems to suggest that it's actually the terraforming device that brings her back to life rather than her Time Lord DNA.
Yeah. Or it's a combination of the both, but it's not adequate.
But yeah,
explained.
It's not. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, yeah. But that she is alive at the end gives it a little extra lift.
Yeah. I think so, and also that the idea of there's another person out there who's learned from the Doctor. Because, I mean, Russell T is very good at creating this kind of vast universe from which to kind of pluck ideas from. He never does when it comes to Jenny, nor does Stephen Moffat. But it's nice to, you know, it's nice to have these other characters out there.
Yeah.
That, you know, and that kind of just adds this kind of depth to the world in which Doctor Who takes place, and that's why fans lose their nut over like, ooh, who could this be? Will it be this character? Will it be that character? Yeah. Will it be, you know, it's kind of nice in a way. I know I bang on about, oh, fucking grow up, it's not going to be that, but it is kind of fun sometimes to read some of the utterly insane theories that people come up with.
Yeah.
I mean, we've not given it a kick in, but we've not been particularly...
No, because it's not a bad episode.
Story. No, it's not. It's...
But it does seem like Doctor Who by numbers, trying to get through its own life as quickly as possible.
It's Doctor Who by numbers when it shouldn't be Doctor Who by numbers, when it should be something doing something different.
Yeah.
And I think that's his major flaw.
Yeah. It just seems like a missed opportunity rather than anything badly made.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's
so. Yeah, there are positives. Georgia Moffat is great.
It's great,
Jenny,
yeah.
And
it's
down to her performance that we say it's a shame that Jenny hasn't come back. Mm-hmm. Because essentially, what we've got in Maisie Williams is a similar sort of character, mm-hmm. a kind of counterpoint to the Doctor. Some things, someone that really needs the Doctor there as a kind of fatherly guidance figure.
Yeah.
I don't like Maisie Williams as much as I like Georgia Moffat in this.
Mm, yeah, I agree. I think Georgia Moffat as Jenny is a really... She's an instantly likable presence,
yeah.
I think.
You also get the very, very quick character arc played out in a very respectable, adequate amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she plays it really well.
Yeah.
You don't get a sense like there's some weird jumps between what she's doing.
No.
Like,
there's a clear journey.
Journey. There we are. Okay. I was
trying to avoid
that word, but yes, her journey. Yeah, she does the journey very well.
Yeah, I mean, that's very clear. And I think, like I say, she is very likeable from the moment she steps out of that thing.
Yeah.
I mean, did we talk about this? I can't remember. Did we talk about this in the Santaran episode? Of acting for the trailer rather than acting for the actual episode.
Oh, no, we didn't. But yeah, I see what you mean, yeah.
Because there's a bit of that at the start, but you go, fair enough, it's the pre-titles.
Yeah.
Because that is the new cliffhanger, really, for Doctor Who in this modern era. But she's very good, and I think, you know, she's somebody who is both eager to please the Doctor and eager to be accepted by him, but then at the same time is kind of got this kind of warlike gene in her as well. And it's kind of, she plays that kind of balance between the two very well, in a very likeable way.
All right, favourite scene, Mark, go on.
My favourite scene is the Doctor and Donna. Well, I've got two. The Doctor and Donna, you know, that whole you talk all the time, you don't see anything. Yeah. I think that's great, because that is the Doctor. Well, certainly the 10th Doctor.
Yeah.
Nailed down right there. He's this kind of guy that's just constantly moving, constantly chatting to distract from the fact that maybe he thinks that this plan won't work when he's defeating a monster, or maybe he's, you know, and all that kind of thing. Or distract him from the very fact that he never actually talks about himself.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a very Doctorish characteristic. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I suppose we see in the Zygon inversion as well, is that, you know, actually that's one of the few times in which he talks about his own motivations and his own things. So I quite like that scene, because I think it works so well, because David Tennant and Catherine Tate have this brilliant chemistry with each other, and it is just like two friends that have a lovely time together, but actually don't really know that much about each other, and that's kind of sad in a way, and you know, maybe they should know more. I like that very much. Like I say, I like the man who never would scene,
yeah,
out of to just take it out and put it on YouTube as a best of Doctor Who thing. I think that's a great scene. But actually what leads up to it doesn't necessarily earn the right to have that scene, but I think it's a very well written, very well acted scene nonetheless.
This is not a scene, it's just there's outrageous amounts of running.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. I thought that was great.
Yeah, that is true.
And I quite like Martha's and Donna's scene at the end.
Yeah, that's good. That is quite good.
Yeah. Because it's actually the opposite of a lot of other Cheerio scenes. Because usually they're like covered in snow or it's sunshine or something like that.
Yeah.
This is a very obviously, it's been pissing the rain.
Yeah, it's just a very drizzly miserable day.
Shitty winter's day. Right, you're dumped. Bye, see you later.
Yeah.
Enjoy home time.
But the thing is, like, God, like, if you're Martha Jones, you're like, fuck it, I can't. I'm so glad to be home.
Yeah.
I'm fucking done with that blue box. Every time I get in that blue box, it's fucking torturous.
Yeah. Home to my marriage, which will fail within the next year.
Yeah, and I'm going.
And then I'll get married to Mickey the Idiot.
We're gonna. Oh, see when we have to deal with that, I'm gonna be getting quite angry.
Why?
I hate that.
Well, that they got together.
Yeah.
There is a certain quality of going, right, but we've only got a certain amount of time, and you two black actors get together, you're in one thing together.
Yeah.
There's a bit of disrespect there. Right, okay, again.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
So, favourite performance? George Moffat, isn't it? Yeah, it is. Nobody else.
Best thing, innit?
Yeah. Well, none of the humans are any good. I know what you mean. The General Cobb is miscast.
Mm-hmm.
He looks like he should be running a fucking...
I think if he'd gone for... Because
he seems like a snake oil salesman, yeah, rather than...
If he was going to be... If the whole idea was that he's been there since the beginning, yeah, and he's been driven mad by what he's seen and what he's experienced over these 7 days,
yeah,
fine. But it's never done that in the script. Yeah. So what I think they should have gone for was...
Not even hinted at.
Yeah, like a slightly older young adult.
Yeah. Yeah, if it was like...
Like that kind of Red Dawn or like Hunger Games kind of thing where it's like, you know,
yeah,
youngsters.
If they, ironically, we gave Ryan Sampson not a kicking. I don't think we were that kind to him in Sondheim.
I wasn't.
Stratagem. If it was something like Ryan Sampson,
mm-hmm,
doing
that
Ratigan character, mm-hmm, and being the General Cobb character, I think we'd have had
It would have made a bit more sense.
Yeah. Okay. That's The Doctor's Daughter. Seemed like it was a bit of an experiment. I don't know. It didn't pull it off.
It could have been a lot.
There could have and should have been a bit more,
yeah,
going on there.
There should have been another way.
Yeah. So we're going to recharge our glasses and we're going to come back for...
Galaxy 4!
God...
Do you know what? Well, we'll come to this later. Galaxy 4 in the jingles time.
Right, we're back, and it's Galaxy 4. That's what we paired The Doctor's Daughter with, as we discussed in The Doctor's Daughter incorrectly.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's still... The Dravens are still bred for war.
Yeah.
So we've still got that. Maga has kind of reinvented her own history as well.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Okay, yeah. But
there's still... The main reason we chose is kind of wrong.
Yeah.
But there's still little threads in there.
The main reason was the don't judge appearances by... No, don't judge character by appearances.
Yeah.
But yeah, okay. So Galaxy Force. So this is let's. Has this been the toughest? Because this is we're going to piece this guy together.
Yeah. Done this before.
We've done missing episodes before, but this one was quite a toughie to track down.
Yeah.
Because usually, so Loose Cannon do all the reconstruction. Mm-hmm. But they no longer operate as a dubbing site now.
No.
So you find all of their stuff online. For some reason, legally, they had to take down the reconstruction of episode one.
Yeah.
So you had to really... So I think finally it was on Daily Motion.
I tracked it down on Daily Motion, but I also found a torrent that had the... basically all the reconstructions and Airlock, the rediscovered Airlock.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just went, oh, well, that's easier because I can download that. Put that on my PlayStation, just watch it on the telly.
Yeah.
Fine. So I did that rather than kind of watch the reconstruction on YouTube, then stick the Aztec special edition on, and then watch the Airlock on that, and then go back.
That's what I did. You know, that was that was more difficult than just watching all
so,
of the reconstructions.
You know, for the purposes of legal reasons, I do own Galaxy 4 Episode 3 Airlock on DVD.
Yeah.
So that was purely a backup.
Yeah.
That I had sourced myself. But yes, it was a bit tough.
Yeah, it was.
Well, was it though? I mean, I watched part one on my lunch break from work, and I actually quite enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I think it's an absolute bloody blessed relief when you get to Airlock, and it's an episode of Doctor Who you can watch.
Aye, but like, isn't episode two? Don't they have like half of it? Like,
there's about
11 minutes.
Yeah, there's quite a large part of that still exists.
Basically,
which is in the Loose Cannon reconstruction, they cut to that and then it kind of picks up.
Yeah, and it's on Lost in Space.
It's on Lost in Time.
Lost in Time DVD.
Lost in Time.
You can find it. It's easy to find.
So, I mean, yeah. So there's bits and pieces of it that do exist, but it was a bit of a struggle. By the time part four, I think, because what I found especially with parts two and part four is that the sound mix was awful. On the reconstruction, like the dialogue was kind of fighting with the music, and it was and the sound effects, and sometimes it was quite hard to kind of hear what was going on. But that's par for the course.
So this is one of the main problems. So with the Loose Cannon reconstructions, exemplary work.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
They are ultimately fans who don't have the BBC, you know, reconstruction team.
So they can't
stuff. So they can't
remaster the sound.
Isn't a Mark Ayers job. Haven't been tarted up. Things don't sound great.
Yeah.
So what was available to us just casually was this kind of original audio recordings that were made untempered.
It was funny. I was thinking about this certainly after part one. It's kind of incredible that even those exist.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, who was, you know, recording
what was it about Doctor Who that attracted people to episode one that people started recording Doctor Who?
Because, I mean, Marco Polo exists like that, doesn't it?
Marco Polo exists, the
audio soundtracks of that. It's an incredible thing. It's an incredible notion that...
But is it because we're Doctor Who fans that we know about this? Are there areas of other kind of television fandom?
Well,
like, say, does Adam Adamant exist?
Dad's Army, though. Dad's Army's a good example because that's something I know about.
Yeah.
The Dad's Army DVDs for the first... Is it the first two series of Dad's Army where there's episodes that are missing?
Yeah.
What they have on those DVDs is it's not the soundtracks of the episodes, it's the radio versions that they did. And you can listen to those.
Sure.
So obviously James Beck isn't playing Walker,
because
he's sadly passed away by the point that they recorded the radio series. So that's what you have, because they still exist in the archives.
Yeah.
What you don't have is this kind of, somebody held a microphone up to... So it seems to be this kind of weirdly exclusively Doctor Who thing. Maybe that was a habit at the time, but it's because there's this completionist aspect to being a Doctor Who fan that you track.
Aye, but from episode one.
I know.
Who sits down and watches On an Earthly Child and go, right, well, I'm with this till the bitter end.
Yeah, it's odd, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is odd that these things exist. And it's great.
As a Peter Cook and Dudley Moore fan,
uh-huh.
I'd love if they discovered more episodes.
Yeah.
But
Has anyone got the recordings of those episodes, not only but also?
I know.
Like the audio recording, so you at least, because, I mean, there's not a lot of visual comedy in that. It's very verbal.
It is weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a very weird thing. And I wonder if it's more to do with the kind of, like I say, that completionist aspect to Doctor Who fans, is that there were people out there going, did anybody back in the 60s record the audio for Marco Polo?
Yeah.
If so, get in touch. Was it that kind of thing? I mean, we weren't around in those days when these sort of reconstructions... Well, we were, but, you know, we weren't aware of the work that went into putting these reconstructions... Which, you know, for what they are, they are very good. And they, I suppose they're the only way to experience these shows. I mean, there's a slight Gerry Anderson quality, certainly to the Galaxy 4 reconstruction, in which there's a lot of close-ups of hands... tinkering with walls or shooting guns or
my favourite bit about the reconstructions that they did for Reign of Terror is there's one scene in some of the surviving episodes where Ian walks in a room and the door opens enough before his body comes through that every time in the reconstruction somebody comes in a door
it's
this swingy door. It's just the same shot of a swinging door opening and closing. You must see that about fucking 7 times an episode. It's funny,
but how great that these things exist.
Well, people, I mean, okay, I can completely understand why people are so up in arms about, are there missing episodes that are being hidden from us or not? One of the other things to consider is we could have literally no idea about Marco Polo at all.
Yeah.
It could completely be lost. It could have just been gone.
Or we, you know, we would have maybe had a novelisation and that was it. And that would have been the only way to enjoy it.
You see your telly snaps?
Yeah.
That's it. You can find out what happens, but you have no which, from what I was kind of beginning to say, is that what would have been great is being able to get hold of the BBC soundtrack. But infuriatingly, rather than individual releases now, it's
box,
part of a big 70 quid box, which I don't really want to spend money on. Because, so the Galaxy 4 box has got Marco Polo on it, which is worthwhile.
Yeah,
Reign of Terror, some of the episodes already exist, and there's the animated thing.
Which is very good.
Yeah, there's, what else is on it? But there's like... you know, like there's a lot of stuff in there. Like, if you're shelling out 70 quid, you're already getting material you've already got and possibly better represented elsewhere. But they've just decided to keep it as a box in there rather than do individual releases, which I'm a bit infuriated by.
I think they are kind of, in terms of sort of Doctor Who spin-off media, and actually, interestingly, over the credits of the Zygon version last night, there was an advert for The Underwater Menace on DVD, which I thought was incredible.
Yeah.
But what I think that we're getting there is, you're right, it is incredible that, you know, these things exist, but the marketing arm of, well, BBC Worldwide is the marketing arm of the BBC, is that they're very much targeting it at people, at Doctor Who fans. You know? So obviously it's a big 70 quid box set, because they'll pay for that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's fans like me and you and loads of other people I know that just say, well, that's...
Yeah, but
I own some of that, and they were single things. And like, why should I pay 70 quid for a box set?
Because
Galaxy 4 did exist as a single.
It did.
Soundtrack
and also on that box set is the Savages, which I've already got as an individual release.
Yeah.
I'm not going to buy the Savages again.
No.
So there's been a real decision to go, right,
we'll just bundle them all together and then...
Yeah, but you can't buy them individually now.
But, I mean, for me, I think what I said this when we talked about the Web of Fear, and, you know, feel free to, you know, publicly flog me and call me a terrible Doctor Who fan, but I haven't gone out of my way to track down Doctor Who stories that no longer exist. Partly because...
Well, we still live in hope.
Well, partly because of that. And also partly because, as we discussed last time when we talked about the invasion, because obviously two episodes of that are missing, there's certain little nuances of performance, there's certain little sort of physical touches that you can't get in a reconstruction, you can't get in an animated reimagining of the story. And I think that's why a lot of these classic stories that are missing languish at the bottom of polls sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, look at The Enemy of the World. It shot up like 20 odd places, you know, when people actually got to see the thing. Because actually, in terms of dialogue, it's not that interesting a story. But part one, is this really exciting, almost James Bond movie in which there's a hovercraft chase.
It's exactly what we said about episode 4 of The Invasion, where it's like a helicopter rescue from the top of a factory.
And it doesn't exist.
And you just go, well, I don't even...
Yeah.
This animation, which surely the possibilities are limitless, is doing nothing to help conjure up what we're actually being shown.
So what I really enjoyed
can
about
you imagine,
this...
Tell you what, here's can you imagine if... what's that mental chase episode of Planet of the Spiders? Can you imagine if that was Lost and then somebody like that was just an animation?
You just couldn't... You couldn't recreate that. You couldn't recreate it. And that's the thing, I think it's a great shame and that these things don't exist, but I think also, obviously it's a great thing that they do in some form. But sadly, I've never been tempted to kind of properly throw myself into getting the soundtracks to watching the loose canon reconstruction, which is what I enjoy about doing this podcast, is that I get to see Doctor Who that I don't really know much about, which leads us rather neatly to Galaxy 4.
Yeah, okay, well, let's do the stats for Galaxy 4. So, it was broadcast between the 11th of September and the 2nd of October, 1965. All the episodes going out either 5:40 or 5:50 for 25 minutes.
Okay.
There's an average of about, flapping about the place, all over the shops, there's an average of about 10 million. 9 million for episode 1, all the way to 11.3 million for episode 3. But where is it in the first 5 decades poll? Do you think?
I would imagine, like, as I have already stated in this section of the podcast, that these sort of missing stories tend to be quite low down, and also Galaxy 4 isn't that great.
Well, okay.
I enjoyed it a lot more than I expected to.
Nail your colours to the mask.
Well, no, I enjoyed
it. Fannying about.
I enjoyed it more than I expected to, but I know it is not held in the highest esteem.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go with 184.
Lower, 210.
210.
Between Terminus and the Creature from the Pit. Fucking hell. Even as a Doctor Who fan, if somebody went, oh, you want to come around? I'm going to have a Doctor Who triple bill. Oh, yeah, we have Terminus, Galaxy 4, Creature from the Pit. Nah, mate, sorry.
I'm working my way from the first 5 decades pull from the bottom to the top.
Fucking hell.
That's a podcast idea.
Eventually that's going to pay dividends, but your first 100 episodes.
Yeah.
Jeez, listen. 210. I know what you mean. Do you know, it's incredibly surprising that this is a series debut.
This is the start of series three, isn't it?
And I mean, what it is the opening of a new series, but what it is like the arse end of what was filmed for the previous series.
Mm.
Because in the 60s, they always used to record more in a block and then hold over and put that out. So, we didn't finish with the Time Meddler. They didn't finish with the Time Meddler. They had to do Galaxy 4 Mission to the Unknown. And I think the Mythmakers.
Possibly, because obviously he leaves in the
first episode back. I think that was the first episode back, actually, when they started the new recording block. But that's what it seems like. It seems, from what survives, it does seem a bit like people are out of... just out of budget and out of ideas. There's a bit of a tiredness about it.
It's one of those great things about Doctor Who is that although the budget lets it down, the ambition of it, and that never really kind of goes away. It's always, and I think that again with the Doctor's Daughter, it has ambition. They're not necessarily, it's not realised in the best possible way, but it is. It has these big ideas that it's trying to deal with, and I think Galaxy 4 has some really good stuff in it.
Yeah, well, the ambition is that it's trying to do something different to Doctor Who before and arguably after this point as well. It's trying to be about monsters, but the wrong sort or the right sort, however you want to think about it.
But it's about. Well, I don't know. Do we want to go down this road after we've talked about? It, in some ways, it's kind of, 1965 are we in?
Yes.
So, kind of height of civil rights and all that kind of thing. There's, there's this message of, just because you don't look like us doesn't mean that you're not somebody to be trusted, not somebody to be accepted and to be welcomed into this society, somebody to be saved. And I think that's an interesting message for Doctor Who to be kind of... dealing with at this particular period in history.
Yeah.
It's that, you know, the blonde-haired, blue-eyed, beautiful women are actually terrible, evil villains.
Yeah.
And the ugly rhinoceros tentacle, whatever they are, are
they're scary. They look. I mean, you can never get a proper.
You never get a proper look at them, no.
But there is just an idea of disgust that comes off the screen. But they're actually very wise, very malleable, very friendly.
Yeah, and helpful.
Yeah.
You know, they want to help the Draven, but the Dravens, because of their own prejudices, will never agree to that. And that is what will ultimately destroy them. And I think that's a really great Doctor Who story. It's kind of a shame that what we actually get is a bit of a runaround, a bit of a kind of budget saving, where we have to go from here to there. And once again,
The standard kind of deserty planet with a kind of cyclorama in the background,
And slightly unconvincing robot threat because they're still trying to replicate the Daleks.
The thing about the Chumleys is that there is a real smart idea behind the Chumleys, but it never comes off in the way it should be.
Yeah,
they are obviously 100% designed to look like the Daleks. But not for the reason I would think that people think. It's not like a cheap cash in. It's a kind of idea where they go, they look like the Daleks, so they're hopefully, the production team want the audience, they want them to elicit that they're like the Daleks.
You've got the sound effect in the spaceship.
Yeah. But when you see the Chumleys and you think they're obviously something menacing because things before this point which look like them have been menacing, it's supposed to be setting up that the reveal that they are the servants of the goodies is all the more important and shocking and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great turn of events.
Absolutely.
And it just doesn't work like that.
And I think structurally,
because the Chumleys just look a bit
shit.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I was like, well, no, I'm being unfair because, you know, we don't know how they moved, etc., etc., etc. Then you get to part three and you see how they move and you go, yeah, they're a bit shit. They've got this kind of wobbly antennae at the top.
Yeah.
And the layer, it's like basically like four plastic salad bowls stuck together. So they're all kind of moving of their own accord.
Yeah.
Each section.
So the realization they look like the Daleks, but they're actually really helpful.
Yeah.
It doesn't quite pay off.
It's
blunted by the fact that you don't quite buy into why the Doctor, Vicky and Stephen are so scared of them because one punt with their foot and a stick or whatever, there should be shards of plastic flying everywhere and that's that, you know?
But I think also the way the story is structured as well is it works really well to that end.
Yeah.
It's that, you know, they don't meet the good guys to begin with. But that's how it's played out.
Yeah, it's not immediately revealed.
Yeah. You basically, these little rubbish robot things are chasing them. They get rescued by these people. What I love about it is that the Doctor isn't sure that these are actually the good guys.
Yeah.
I think that's a really nice touch. Because often it is just kind of just like, oh, well, you know. So they meet these people, they go, right, so they're the enemy that has to be defeated, so we will go and do that, and then you'll help them defeat the bad guys, and then they'll all go off happily ever after. What you get here is that the Doctor's unsure of these, of the Dravens, right from the off.
Yeah.
And I think that's a nice little bit, because, like, if you do look at the history of Doctor Who, you look at Doctor Who, like, you know, he is incredibly trusting on people often.
Yeah.
When perhaps he should not be.
Yeah.
So it's quite nice to see him here in those scenes. He goes, well, you know, we only have your word for that. That these are terrible. Yeah. These are terrible things, you know. We haven't met them yet. They could be absolutely fine.
Yeah, but the interesting thing as a viewer is that you do watch it and you do go, okay, well, possibly there seems something untrustworthy about the Dravens, but maybe that's just because they're three-dimensional. Like,
They're
maybe the lesser of two evils, but they're still the one nominally in the right. You know?
You're
right. It is interesting that the Doctor. But then again, it's just because, I mean, the good idea behind the story is fairly ham-fistedly executed.
Yes, true.
You know?
True.
Because when you actually get to, and it is great that you know, like Fate of All Fates, the most important episode of the story is episode 3, and that's the one
which exists.
To us.
Yeah, it is good. It's
but
so
that's where
good
it becomes
that
a bit more ham-fisted. You know,
possibly, but I mean, I think it has so many kind of striking little moments in it.
Oh, absolutely.
That I think that's why, you know, like I know Galaxy, you know, 210 in the poll.
Yeah.
And it's not looked on very well.
Was that, so the poll obviously that was brought out 2013, was that before it was returned, Airlock?
It was after.
It was after.
But when did the Aztec Special Edition come out? Because remember, because I remember, because it was returned in December 2011. I remember this distinctly.
But we didn't get to immediately see it.
We didn't get to immediately see it. It was shown at the Missing Believed Wiped event at the BFI.
Yeah.
As like a surprise in December 2011. I remember this because it was when I was in Margate and in the View Cinema at the time, and I remember somebody, like I was just like looking at something on online, and somebody was trying to talk to me, and I wasn't really interested in what they were saying to me, because that's how respectful I was of my colleagues, and I just went, fucking hell, they've discovered two missing episodes of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And they were like, what? I was like, sorry, what were you saying? I wasn't really paying attention. So yes, it was around then.
Two episodes.
Yeah.
You must have shit your pants when two stories came out.
I know, right? yeah, so it was the same time as The Underwater Menace.
Yeah.
Was rediscovered.
Yeah, which we're only seeing now.
Exactly, it's taken such a long time. So yeah, so they put... Because the Aztec Special Edition was only out, what, last year, year before?
No, I think it was a 2013 thing, was it?
Okay. But maybe before that poll came out. Maybe after, sorry, before that poll came in. But even then, you know, maybe there's not enough in it to kind of make people reevaluate it. But it features that flashback scene, which is quite weird for that period of Doctor Who. I mean, now... And
a pretty full-on brutal as well.
Yeah, yeah, there's blood.
You see a murder happen.
Yeah.
It doesn't cut away.
No, no. And she's covered in blood as well beforehand, before she's sort of put out of her misery, as it were.
Yeah.
And that's a really striking
it's
thing.
It's essentially the character that General Cobb should have had.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Marga.
Because over those four episodes, that character develops.
Yeah.
And we get an insight into why they're doing the things they're doing.
Yeah.
Which you never get with General Cobb.
Yeah. Which is another plus point for the story.
Yeah.
Is that there is some kind of character development for the baddies as well as the goodies.
Yes,
they're not. It is shades of grey. It is not black and white in this thing.
Exactly, exactly. And I one of my favourite scenes in the whole thing is, you know, that great sort of Doctor Who scene where the Doctor's like, "Well, if I mess with this machine, I'll be able to do this." And then it's actually they flip that on its head and go, "No, if you do that, you're going to kill." You're going to kill everybody.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
and these
are
the good guys. These are actually the good guys, not the bad guys.
Yeah. There's also, I mean, watching it back, there is a lot of modern element of Doctor Who.
Mm.
Which is, I've got some equipment in the TARDIS. Let me fiddle about with it and everyone can leave this planet and everything's all fine.
Yeah.
You know, because you don't really associate Hartnell's Doctor with that. Nipping back to the TARDIS to get equipment that will solve the problem.
Yeah, because in the 60s Doctor Who, very often, certainly in the Hartnell era, it's they're cut off from the TARDIS,
yeah.
You know, and they have to go on a journey, like in the Reign of Terror.
Tell you what, the first Doctor's adventures always reminds me of. Remember the show Sliders?
Yes.
Like the TARDIS really is just the thing. The TARDIS is the equivalent of the kind of
the little portal
opening up, depositing them, and then they can't do fuck all
until it resets itself.
Until the thing's been recharged, and then they've got to go again.
Yeah.
This is like you can just nip back and go, yeah, we'll be on our way in 10 minutes.
Yeah,
we'll be fine. If nobody's a dick about this, we'll get out of this.
Okay.
It always reminds me of that kind of thing. So to be honest, there's a lot of very positive things we're saying about Galaxy 4.
I genuinely was really surprised by how much I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and got out of it as well.
Yeah, but, I mean, I completely concede to people that, you know, go, oh, it's a bit...
It is repetitive.
It's repetitive,
there
it's
are
a bit
boring
of a
elements
around,
to it.
Yeah.
What we can see of the production...
Yeah,
just looks a bit tired. Like, look at the Rills spaceship.
Yeah,
it's all kind of like it's a bit of garden furniture decking
and polythene and it's the bit where the Doctor's I can't move it. It's immovable. Okay. You're like, you could probably just rip that off its hinges to be honest, and she'll be
and the gaps between the meshing.
Yeah.
Vicky could quite easily step through
or underneath. Yeah, there's, I mean, yeah, it's not
Yeah.
Great.
And if the reconstructions are anything to go by, there's a lot of the Chumleys' tops going up, and then the tops coming down again, and then they're going back up. But yeah. And I'm like bumping into the side of the TARDIS as they go around it. And there's all that kind of stuff. It's that weird kind of... It's that weird kind of just middle of the road, boring.
Yeah.
Series 2, Series 3 kind of feel about it.
No, I think that's fair, but I think there's also it is doing some interesting things.
Yeah, certainly. It's unlike in its approach at any rate. It's unlike Doctor Who before that point.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So this idea that like 60s Doctor Who was just kind of cookie cutter.
Yeah.
Everything was the same. It's not. True. There's a real attempt to do something different here. And yeah, they obviously don't have the budget for it because they've spent it. But that they've reserved such a great idea for the end of a production block to hold it over for another series.
Yeah.
Does suggest that there's... Which is maybe unfair in an adventure in time and space, that after Verity Lambert leaves, it's just a lot of combative, very workman-like producers and writers and editors.
But Lambert's still on board at this point, though.
Yeah, but she's checking out by this point. Like,
this is the last series, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, this is her last major thing, and she's gone on Mission to Unknown. So it's John Wiles at this point who is nominally producer.
Yeah,
he's shadowing her, but he's the guy making all the decisions at this point.
Yeah.
So it's and John Wiles, I think, gets a bit of a, you know, because he's the guy that was always combative with William Hartnell. So.
But I think, I mean, you know, Mark Gatiss has never said that it's the definitive, you know, look at the making of Doctor Who.
No, but there's a ton of people that are going to take that as shorthand.
Yeah. But that is what it is. I mean, because the story, it's a story about the making of Doctor Who, and then... It's like, well, what happened to William Hartnell after that? So you kind of gloss over those middle bits. No disrespect to anybody, but it kind of just... Because you've only got an hour and a half to film.
Yeah.
And a lot of the interesting stuff is just how you get...
No, I know. I know. I get it. But what we have here is... Maybe it's because Series 3 is missing. That
yes, so much of it is missing, yeah.
But there's a... You know, in the way that kind of like... The majority of Patrick Troughton's stuff is missing, so you kind of feel like you don't really get a sense of him as a... It's a great shame you don't get a sense of him as a Doctor. But there's a lot of that final season of Hartnell's that's missing.
Yeah.
That a lot of people just kind of... It's dismissed. Because...
Yeah, no, I agree.
It's missing, but it's just dismissed as if it's made by like a production team that don't give a shit. You know, like, it's the equivalent of Series 3 of Star Trek, the original series. Like, people just don't give a shit. It's not like a thing. Like, enjoy Series 1, enjoy Series 3. I wonder why that is.
I think partly because it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You don't get to see what was going on, really.
But, like, Galaxy 4 does suggest that there is intellectually, there's a new team keen to tackle the idea of Doctor Who as a show, rather than just make the stuff that they've had previous 2 years.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think,
Because what do you... I mean, like, CDC, what do you have after this?
Well, you've got...
Mission to the Unknown.
Mission to the Unknown.
Brave, none of the regulars are in it.
Yeah, none of the regulars. It's just a 25-minute space adventure.
Yeah, you have the Mythmakers, which is, I think, a little dry, but it is another kind of attempt to be a funny historic.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the absolutely batshit mental Daleks Master Plan, which, that's the main thing I want to see back.
I'd
love to see, because I love
it
as an audio.
How great would that be?
I love the episodes that exist. And you got the arc, which is just weird from start to finish.
I love the arc.
You finish the series with the War Machines, which is one of my favourites.
Yeah, the War Machines is fantastic.
And the Savages is just... The Savages, I don't know if I like it. I don't dislike it, but there's just something...
Yeah.
There's just something... And there's the Massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve.
Yeah.
Which is maybe the single least Doctor Who story. Because you get rid of your lead actor, only for him to be a different character for the majority of it. So you think, oh, well, it's obviously like a Doctor Light story, but it's not, because you've still got
him. You've got him, but he's somebody else.
Being like a monk guy.
It is interesting, that last sort of Hartnell series. Because obviously Series 4 opens with
So you got eight episodes.
The Savages, doesn't it?
Yeah. Savages.
Terrifier.
No, sorry, the Smugglers. It's the Smugglers.
The Smugglers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because Savages in Series 3, isn't it?
So yeah. So it's the Savages, the War Machines, the Smugglers, yeah. The Tenth Planet.
Yeah, because Stephen leaves the end of Savages.
Sure does,
of course. But you get. I mean, as much as obviously all of the Doctor Who before then is important.
Yeah.
Of course it is. In where we are now.
Enough from episode one to be sitting there with a recording device.
Yeah, with a fucking microphone held to the television, yeah. Going, I'm going to record all of this.
A little trip around a junkyard with some teachers and go, well, I'm sold.
Yeah.
I'm investing in a reel-to-reel machine. Because
I really want to find out what happens next week.
This smells like it has rewatch quality.
It's mad, isn't it? What was I saying?
Yes, sorry.
So, but with like something like the War Machines.
Yeah.
That's the kind of, that's the Pertwee era. That story is essentially the Pertwee era.
Yeah.
In template.
Yeah.
And then you get the Tenth Planet, which is your first base under siege.
Yeah.
And then, so it is like those last Hartnell years are really important.
Yeah.
In kind of the way the series ends up going, and the series that we have now. So yeah, you're right, but I think because it doesn't exist, it doesn't quite get the praise or the respect that perhaps
it
deserves.
Well, for exactly what you argued at the start of the episode, that you have not been moved to seek out episodes that don't exist.
Yeah.
Don't apologise, because other people are obviously not either. You know.
I mean, I suppose if I had a long car journey or a long flight or something like that, I would be tempted to stick on some of the BBC soundtracks.
Yeah.
You know, and listen to those, because I think, you know, they're very well put together. But I do find, as good as they are at sort of trying to put an episode together, like when we did the Faceless ones, you know, I thought a lot of those reconstructions were good. The Evil, the Power of the Daleks, again. But it's a struggle. Because you're watching static image, then a static image.
Yeah.
And you're trying to follow the story through dialogue and occasional kind of...
Yeah.
It's not as simple as kind of just sitting back and going, oh, I'm going to watch Doctor Who. You know, you're putting the work in.
Yeah.
And I'm not for a second suggesting that I want Doctor Who to be a passive experience. I think we've proved through 37 episodes of this podcast that it's not.
You are more agile in your watching of the show without getting back 100% of the experience.
You're putting in a lot of work. And, you know, again and again, and I just want to keep hammering this point home, so are the people who are reconstructing these episodes, putting in a lot of work, and not getting much in return.
Yeah.
Out of the sheer love for this television programme. And there is nothing else like it in the world.
Well, nobody's putting together, you know, reconstructions of Dad's Army, or not only, but also.
No, they're not.
That kind of thing.
And I don't know if that just says a lot about the kind of the borderline autistic nature of the Doctor Who fan, or if that just says something really wonderfully positive and just brilliant about the sort of people that Doctor Who attracts as a show. Maybe it's both. It's probably both.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably a lot of people who've gotten to reconstructions want to do it because they want to get to grips with that episode.
Yeah.
And the only way to do it is be involved in its production process in some way.
And I'm glad these things exist. And as we move through the podcast and we run out of stories that are available on DVD, and I think, you know, we make our brave choices every now and again. We choose the ones that don't fully exist.
Yeah.
And sometimes we'll choose ones that don't have animated episodes in the DVD.
Yeah.
But I'm glad we did it.
The air out of the airlock and you will die. Or you can go outside where there are chumleys, which we call them chumleys even though
we call them chumleys now because you did.
It was a weird name that girl gave them.
One of my favourite bits in it is when the Rose goes, you call them chumleys.
Yeah.
What the fuck does that mean?
do you know what the Rills always remind me of? It's like a really, you know, like a...
like a gin-soaked grand old uncle, just laughing.
Just a massive red nose.
Yeah, like you brought the kids over to meet the uncle, and he's just so. What a laugh it is to have kids describing the world to him, because all he does is sit by the fire and drink fucking cognac or something. You call them shovelers? I suppose they are! Oh, fucking yes!
But yeah, it's a sort of, because I've always known them as the, because me and you had this running joke, was it in Doctor Who magazine or something, where it was like, show us your Chumleys. I can't remember, me and you had this conversation in which I distinctly remember, was it maybe around Christmas time? Oh no, shit, no, I know what it was, I text you to go, oh, have you seen the news?
Yeah.
About finding
a Galaxy 4. What headline would they go with?
Yeah, and what headline would they go with? And you went, oh, show us your Chumleys.
Get your Chumleys
out. Get your Chumleys out. But then when you actually watch it, it's just like, yeah, they've got a kind of Chumley movement. And you're like, is that a future word, Vicky, from where you're from? Because that's not a measure of movement that I'm familiar with.
I've never seen anything that I would go, oh, look at that fucking Chumley chumbling about.
All right, mate, just chumbling up to the shops, are you? No. What the fuck does that mean?
Yeah.
Is that
a future word?
Is it a future word?
Because you forget that Vicky is from far in the future, so what's her point of reference? Yeah. You know.
Yeah, but actually, on Vicky, I think this story kind of just reminded me of the kind of sense that the Vicky does become a kind of surrogate granddaughter to the First Doctor.
Yeah, they just keep writing Susan.
They just write the Susan character until we get to kind of Polly and stuff like that.
Yeah. Polly's the first time something different happens to Doctor Who girls. It looks like it's a different. Dodo is even the same. Dodo's like a non-entity.
Yeah, but then again, is that because we don't have much of her stories?
Nah, it's a non-entity.
I just found it quite interesting.
But then I've always said this, that Ben and Polly are one of the greatest unsung creations in Doctor Who.
Yeah, I agree.
Before. Because they were specifically created to be something different and designed to do a thing, i.e. to be the new Ian and Barbara. Mm. Well, I say new, like 4 years later, to be Ian and Barbara again, different, in order to help change the Doctor over. Which is a great shame, because the rescue, Vicky is fucking outstanding.
I love
Maureen O'Brien.
Yeah,
is outstanding.
It's really
that.
Good. A lot of fun.
But then, nothing again.
No.
Occasionally, there's some good moments in the Crusade.
Hmm.
But it's and certainly within the first couple of episodes of the Time Meddler, when her and Stephen.
Yeah.
Are
and
really,
she's there as the kind of.
Yeah. I love the Time Meddler. Have we done the Time Meddler?
Hmm.
We haven't.
No, we should soon though, because it was.
I fucking love the Time Meddler.
I think that and the Mind Robber were the first two Doctor Who stories I ever saw.
Have we not? I watched it recently. Why did I do that? I mean, it's good, but like my Doctor Who now is
my Doctor Who's this or the what's on
well,
the,
that, yeah,
what's
that's
on the telly.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
basically kind of.
Did I actually do that dangerous thing of watching Doctor Who for recreation alone?
Wow, I can't remember the last time I did that.
We've done the Time Meddler.
We haven't. We genuinely haven't done Time Meddler.
All right.
I look forward to the day in which we do.
Yeah. Brilliant. What is you, sir? What is your favourite scene?
My favourite scene? Well, I don't go around killing anybody, and neither do my friends. I love that bit. I love it. Because that's just pitch perfect what the Doctor by this stage, because obviously we've seen him try to brain a caveman with a rock.
Yeah, we've seen him like smack a guy with a cane in the Dalek invasion of Earth.
All that kind of stuff. But this is the kind of the peaceful, where possible, Doctor.
Yeah. But this is the guy, I mean, there's so much given over in modern Doctor Who to this mythology that the Doctor was somehow created at a point before we start watching the series. But it's not.
It's not.
The character of the Doctor and what he stands for and what he is, it didn't happen on Gallifrey.
No, it didn't.
It happened on screen.
Yeah.
In the time that he spent with
Absolutely.
Ian and Barbara, Stephen and Vicky.
Yeah.
You can see him being the Doctor
you can go and find DVDs or soundtracks. You can find this out.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I wrote a letter to Doctor Who magazine to say the very same
thing
about
it. You sure did.
About the Daleks and stuff like that. And I think, you know, you're absolutely right. There is this sense that, oh, you know,
he's so mysterious. He's not.
He's not. He's an alien who landed on Earth in the 1960s, met some human beings, interacted with them, and became a better person.
Yeah.
As a result,
they taught him how to be a hero and to stand up for weaker people and to make a promise. You know, like that idea that the doctor thing is a promise.
It's, you know, it's not.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, I love that line because that's kind of what Moffat's trying to say with the Witch's Familiar.
Yeah.
Where the doctor goes, and yes, on good days, I am the doctor.
Yeah.
You know, it's this mythical thing. The rest of the time, he's just this guy that's a bit unsure of himself and is just kind of a bit selfish,
I think the original idea of the adoption of the name The Doctor has just been a kind of, that's my name now, it's cool, I'm starting afresh. Like, The Doctor only, there's a thing, I think, only really became anything, any kind of meaning to the guy, or the entity, from the Time War.
Yeah,
I think that's when he came. When it came to symbolise something, particularly,
and that's why he had to abandon it and become the.
I think when the first Doctor has it, like, he's just chosen it because
he's on Earth and it seems like a reasonable.
It's a nice little anonymous kind of title to ingratiate himself into that world that he finds himself in. You know.
What's your favourite scene?
What's my favourite scene? What is my favourite scene? I don't know.
It's hard, isn't it? Because
I don't think I really have one.
I think it's very hard with something like Galaxy 4 when so much of it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
That it's hard to choose, unless it's really good dialogue, which there is not much of in Galaxy 4.
If I've got anything, it's probably... I think it's probably the kind of the first meeting between the Doctor and the Rills.
Mm.
And, like, Hartnell does seem... tickled, which is great, which is another thing. You know, you think that Hartnell is in a constant decline, and of it is that, if anything, in his third series as the Doctor, he becomes more adventurous and you know, and outgoing and active. And,
yeah,
you know,
and more charming as well, and more. Yeah, I agree.
History has it that it's a problematic period, and maybe it is, but not a lot of that.
Yeah,
shows.
Maybe behind the scenes, but you know, well, yes, behind the scenes, there's no maybe about it.
Yeah.
But I don't think it shows as much on screen.
Yeah.
As you would believe.
Yeah. Yeah. And my favourite performance. I don't know.
I quite like Stephanie Binmead because I think it's quite a nice.
She has nothing to work with, but she gives it her all.
Yeah, so and it's a slightly different Doctor Who villain than we're used to as well.
Yeah,
but at this stage.
For little fact fans, Eric Idle's wife is in Galaxy 4.
Oh, really?
Or first wife.
Uh-huh.
She's the Draven that guards Stephen.
Oh, the one that
Stephen.
Gets punched in the face when she's asleep.
Yeah.
Well, she doesn't really. She gets, like, knocked off her
chair. Yeah, when Stephen's trying to escape, that's the guard.
Oh, right.
Eric Idle. His wife, there we are. I think that's the laugh.
There we go.
So that's been Galaxy 4. It kind of doesn't feel like we've scratched the surface of it, but there's
nothing
so really
hard to kind of. First of all, there's not. I don't think there's that much. I think we kind of covered the main topic at the start of the discussion.
I don't think we've had the definitive discussion about it because we don't have a definitive version to watch.
Yeah. Perfect. Yeah.
Anyway. Unicorn and the Wasp next,
indeed,
and I'm really excited about that.
Looking forward to that as well.
Yeah.
It was a story that I didn't enjoy that much on first broadcast, but then on second viewing, I absolutely adored it.
Yeah.
So I'm really looking forward to talking about it.
Because, I'll say that before we've watched it, I'm going to say that...
You're a big Agatha Christie fan, aren't you?
I do like Agatha Christie, and I also think that if you're looking at Doctor Who in a 50-minute thing... That's the perfect 50-minute Doctor.
Okay. Yeah.
Where Doctor's daughter just went. You should have been longer.
What are we pairing that up with, Ben? What are we going to pair the Unicorn and the Wasp up with?
Well, we've got a couple of choices, haven't we?
I thought we only had one.
Oh right. Okay.
Did we not have two, and then we chose to do one story?
Well, you'd selected Black Orchid.
Oh, so I did. Yeah.
Yeah. But Ghostlight could also fit into that as well.
And really for no other reason than it's in a kind of period house with something going on.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's as far as we've got. I can't think of anything else that's starred. If we want to look at writers, we could do The Unquiet Dead again.
That's you're forgetting our tone meeting.
Oh.
Because we had this conversation in The Jolly Judge.
Okay, yeah.
And I think I did put forward Black Orchid, and you were like, yeah, fair enough, country house, a bit of a murder mystery.
Yeah.
He said, but if we're wanting to talk about Agatha Christie and Doctor Who stories...
Of course, yes!
...that hark back to Agatha Christie stories...
Terror of because the Vervoids!
Yes!
Terror of the Vervoids!
Which is why I thought you, when you said, oh, well, we've had a few options, I said, well, we've already talked about Robots of Death, so it's only Terror of the Vervoids.
Oh my but God, yes. Terror of the Vervoids!
Terror of the Vervoids, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
We're going to start dipping into the Trial of the Time Lords, because we decided in that meeting...
That you could do...
That you could conceivably do...
Did I say this in a podcast? If I didn't, it's worthwhile saying this now. Terror of the Vervoids... The Trial of a Time Lord, you can conceivably do in individual segments. But it's not four stories, it's three, and it's not told consecutively.
Yes,
so
you did.
So, the Mysterious Planet, and then do Mind Warp, and then The Ultimate Foe as a six-part story.
Yeah.
Right, but in between that, you have another four-part. You have Terror of the Vervoids. I think that's how we're going to approach it.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. Although, quite what we'd pair up Mind Warp and The Ultimate Foe with. Fuck.
A Doctor Gone Bad. There's some Doctor Gone Bad stories that turn out. Well, that's not.
We've got ages yet.
Oh bloody hell! So what do you want to do?
I want to do Terror of the Vervoids. I'd set myself up for Terror of the Vervoids.
That's what we're doing. Terror of the Vervoids.
Terror of the Vervoids. It's
has this ever happened? Has anyone ever gone? We're going to watch Trial of the Time Lord.
I'm really excited
for it. All right, guys. Well, as always, thank you very much for joining us. I've been Ben.
I've been Mark.
If you want to get in contact with us, Facebook, Twitter, email, website, all these places. You know.
Stop us in the street. Whatever you want to do.
Well, yeah, exactly. Stop us in the street.
We're in two different cities. You know, there's a good chance you might bump into us.
Yeah, yeah. I'm London, and
I'm Edinburgh for now.
The Lash Lads in London!
We have to find a new pub. It'll be the one from Survival.
Absolutely, which is like 10 seconds from my front door. So fucking yes. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been amazing as bloody pair listeners.
Yeah.
Join us next time for The Unicorn and the Wasp and Terror of the Vervoids.
I'm excited.
It's going to be good.